Blog Talk Radio.
Thank you, Mystery Jazz Intro. This is Spoken Heard with Susan Dobie Chase, a forum for poets and performing artists of the spoken word variety in the Northern American continent. Today we are blessed to have Critter Martins as our guest. Critter, hello.
Hello. It's nice to be here.
Cool. Sorry, that's Critter Martin. Sorry, I don't know why I added an S onto that.
No, it's M-A-R-T-I-N-S.
I know. For people who are your fans and listening in, and for just the general listening audience, how about we introduce them to a little bit of who you are through a poem?
Okay. Do you want me to just dive right into it then?
Dive right in.
Okay. I'm going to give a content warning for sexual assault before I start. The title is A Witch's Guide to Helping, Volume 1. This is what you do not do when someone tells you they have been sexually assaulted, raped, molested, or otherwise touched in a way which makes the body feel as though it is no longer its own. Some part of you may think it is a lie, an exaggeration. Banish doubt. I don't want it to be true either. No one does. Some part of you may want revenge, to see justice done, to place your hands around the throat of the aggressor, perhaps because you can't face the idea that you failed to protect this person, the feeling that you wish you had been there. Take a deep breath. This is not about you. Yes, there will be time for your healing, but that is later, not in the confession box rampant with frankincense, but with other people who've been lucky enough to escape. And when you go to them to talk, do not say my friend was raped. Unless your confessor is a therapist or some other professional secret keeper, say, I read something about sexual assault and I need to be heard. Lies can be protective and good. This is something witches learn early. This is what you do when your loved one says they have been assaulted. Offer a glass of water. The telling of the fact can make someone leave their body, and water is a gentle way to pull them back again. Banish doubt. Say, I believe you. Say, you did not deserve that. Say, it was not your fault. Offer to say that as many times as they need to hear it. Tell them the story is yours to write. Let them decide whether to be victim or survivor or neither. There is healing to be found in each. Let them keep as many secrets as they want. Let them tell as many secrets as they want. Take those secrets, wrap them with aloe and heather in blue thread, and place them in a secret place. Sing to the secret by the full moon. Whisper, you do not have to tell me anything unless it will help you. Offer them the secret of the witch jar, broken glass, rusted nails, stinging nettle, hematite, and piss. Piss like ownership, like vinegar, eye of an aggressor, in a clean closed jar, buried shallow near your home on the new moon or under Hecate's sickle. This is how you heal yourself when you are done and the survivor is elsewhere. Take a shower, eat something, ground. Today, your body learned a new fear, a new shiver down the spine, a new monster in the crowd around you. Gather your words. Learn not to leave consent ambiguous. Gone are the days without safe words. Gone are the days of I was just joking. Now you must learn to draw the line, to cast a circle and ward your body. Now you must learn the words of power. Red, yellow, green, dubcon, non-con. Now you must learn the true binding names of all these demons. Molestation, harassment, rape culture, coercion. This is what you do to help the community, because healing is not an individual process. Ask before touch, even hug goodbye and hello, unless you have standing permission. Crown the soul, sovereign over its own body. Do not let the demons go unnamed. Whisper, speak, shout, screech, write, draw, dance, sign, until even the banshee notices. But also, ask for touch. Hug, cuddle, hold hands, brush hair, homophobia be damned, adulthood be damned. Romantic relationships are not the only places where you can find warmth. Ask for touch soft enough to pass under these harsh names. Wash feet, give nicknames freely, shower together, lie for hours on kitchen floors and couches and beds, talk about nothing and everything. And when the women go to the streets, go with them. When they ask for people to call the officials, call. When they ask for people to send letters to judges, send one. I cannot explain to you why, because it is an initiation and a mystery. But go if you are able. It is for healing that you do.
Wow. Okay. Where to even begin to talk about that that piece? Besides, it's just marvelous, and it's just an amazing mixture of common sense and poetic image. I mean, common sense advice, excuse me.
Yeah, thank you. I really wanted to give, like, a witchy edge to it because
mm-hmm.
the issue of sexual assault is really important to me, both as, like, a queer person and also as a witch who's concerned with community practice. And
mm-hmm.
I wrote the poem because I wanted to respond to a lot of the poems I'd been hearing from survivors. Sorry, truck.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to respond to them. And so the reason why you hear me say, I believe you, and the reason why there's a line in there, you did not deserve that, is not actually to talk to people who haven't been assaulted, but to talk to people who have been and who have survived.
Right, that comes across.
Yeah, and so the thing that ultimately I was trying to ask myself is it possible to read something that helps other people feel better? Because a lot of the time I go to these open mics and people just have so much to get out on the table, I wanted to be able to give something back.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a really important consideration that a lot of confessional poets don't think of, either because they are, you know, very present in the pain that, produces the poem, but also just in an interpersonal way, confessing is great for the soul, but you also have to consider the person who, you know, is willingly or no your confessor.
Yeah, that's kind of one of the big questions I've been asking with my first year in the spoken word scene is when is it useful to share your pain? When is it useful to you and to others? And when is it not mutually beneficial, right? How many
mm-hmm.
how many poems is it good to sit through where someone is like, it hurts, it hurts, it hurts, without someone then saying, and here's a bandage, and here's some stitches, and here's some disinfectant, and here's a scar that's healed up, and I want to tell you about how I survived it. And I think that a lot of my work is about when I'm in the center of my own practice and not being drawn off with other shiny things. Like the center
mm-hmm.
of my practice as a poet is to try and form a healing narrative around these wounds and around this pain, instead of just letting it turn into like a bunch of fresh cuts bleeding everywhere and no one's reaching for a first aid kit.
Very much agreed. I've always felt like we're not just poets when we're on stage, we're performers, and the idea of not taking people into the pain but not giving them catharsis or some kind of sense of closure or even, you know, something to feel better about life. It's something that I wish a lot of slam poets would consider. I mean, there are brilliant poets out there who it's brutal to listen to 30 minutes of them because every poem is pain and there's never any you know, there's no end to it.
And the thing that's really sad about it is it's not good for the performer either. Like, I found out that they didn't always provide aftercare for poets at places like Brave New Voices and Women of the World Poetry Slam. And so poets were going up on stage in the middle of some, like, power dynamic microaggression situations and revisiting old trauma, and would come off stage, and there was no bottle of water, there was no towel, there was no quiet space to go calm down in. It was just like, oh, yeah, so you just told us this really traumatic story, and now you're going to go sit in a room full of people and listen to more people talk about emotionally heavy stuff. And so to me, if it's not good for the poet and it's not always good for the audience, then who's benefiting?
So
that's why I've been trying to write poems that are that recognize the wound by being a bandage, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, that's so important. I mean, the slam scene didn't even have, you know, safe space coordinators till around 2012, 2013. And I'm pretty sure the idea of, you know, aftercare, trauma therapy or you know, counseling or support is maybe a year or two old at most. The thing I liked, you know, to touch again on that bottle of water in your poem, it's such a beautiful example of, you know, the very common sense, this is something you can do that will help. But also, you know, water is such incredibly powerful imagery, stuff of life, et cetera, et cetera. That was, you know, one of my favorite parts of that piece.
Yeah, and in Reclaiming Witchcraft, we honor water as the water of the womb from which all life springs, but also as a great healer, right? Water cleans wounds. Salt water will help wounds close up way faster. So if you go to the beach, you'll often notice the next day that, like, your cuts and scrapes are a lot better, a lot faster. If you're dehydrated, it starts messing with you in a lot of different ways. Like, you can't get over a cold if you're dehydrated. You aren't always thinking clearly if you're dehydrated. And so this concept of water as healing has old, very magical roots.
Yeah, if I remember correctly from my neo-pagan days, and I say that not to belittle or diminish pagans and Wiccans. It's just, for me, it was something I visited for a while, but, you know, chose a different path. But I want to be real clear that I'm not marginalizing it anyway. If I remember correctly, west is the direction of water and also, you know, the afterlife, the... Okay.
Yeah, no, that's true of many systems, especially those originating in Western Europe. There are other elemental systems in different cultures, and there's other ways to hook up the directions and the elements. And there's actually a book out called Circle of Eight that is full of group activities for people who do ritual to rethink, well, what if we think about eight directions instead of four, and based on our local geography, like, what's the best place to put water in? So, for example, if you were going to run Circle of Eight here in Providence, Rhode Island, you'd probably put water in either the south or the east, because that's where the ocean is.
Right. Well, that makes sense.
But, yeah. Back to...
There you have it, folks.
Back...
poetry and practical advice at the same time. I'm sorry, go on.
And witchcraft, right? Hang a dill over your door. No one with bad intentions can enter your home. But yeah, so back to this notion of ritual, of witchcraft and aftercare and ritual structure, that's another thing that I think is interesting, is that ritual and psychology and art all come together in this kind of, you have to go down and then you do work and then you come back up, right? And that's something that people know in the kink community, and that's something people know in the witchcraft community, but it's not something that, it's something that's only started to kind of make its way into spoken word from what I hear. And so it'll be really interesting to see how these ritual structures that have been adapted to by therapists and by witches and by kinksters, it'll be really interesting to see how that adapts again and becomes this new set of interactions in the spoken word community, because it's also going to become a new language of affection, right? Because the things that you need after you finish reading a poem that's really traumatic is different than the things you're going to need after an hour with your therapist, is different than the things you're going to need after ritual.
And yeah. Speaking of where art and ritual and it all comes together, we're about halfway through the show, if you can believe that. So I was hoping to get you to read another poem.
Oh, that sounds great. There are no content warnings for this one. Drinking.
Okay.
But other than that, we're good. My mother did not move to this country to raise an anti-capitalist queer. It was a lucky summer, half a dozen lovers, endless walks through city streets, drunken hollers in the night. The neighborhood was ours. Not that we owned it. We were welcome to share. Every corner was a commune. Basically, if there is a heaven, and it don't look like Pittsburgh in the summer of 2011, I'll take my chances in hell. I walked into the house after my lover. We were relaxed. The summer air was bath water. And he was there, just a man, but also a legend, a homeowner who had filled his home with queers, an openly trans man working as a nurse, a man who once ate 8 pounds of bacon. Mother had no idea what to do with me. Mr. Cat knew from experience. When I mentioned a haircut, he offered to cut it for me, which, when you're raised in the suburbs, is just the wildest idea ever. 5 minutes later, I'm topless in a chair on the second floor. I'm not topless like exposed. I'm topless like fuck wearing clothes. Mr. Cat is checking the clippers for dog fur. Mr. Cat double-checked. I was ready, just excited. Hair grows back anyway. And when I looked in the mirror, I saw myself looking more like myself than ever. And when Mr. Cat stood behind me and smiled, it was because he had once gotten the same haircut and looked in the mirror and looked more like himself than ever. And when he was 16, a drag queen taught him to do makeup, stood behind him, smiling, maybe behind me too? And who stood behind that queen as we all look forward into this mirror, creating ourselves from frayed edges? Mother could never answer my questions. Mr. Cat knows so many things. What to do when your fiancé is drunk and screeching self-hatred, a series of directionless emptying lungs. What to do when a too small group of hard-headed queers starts to implode from drama. What to do when the anarchist boy from down the street won't let you get a word in. Who knew these would be my adventures? Mother couldn't have known. Mr. Cat does. My parents tried to ready me for life, taught me to use power tools, to cook with cheap food, to be suspicious of men. Mr. Cat has different wisdom, how to pick your name, how to choose your battles. But the most powerful magic this man has is when he says, I believe in you, I believe in me too. I believe in you, and we are standing behind you, smiling.
Oh, how lovely. Poem for this man, Mr. Cat, was it?
Yeah. He's a real person. Can you believe it?
I am stunned to hear a poem about a person being about a person.
Yeah.
But I love that. Go on.
Sorry, you were saying. So I think... So to contextualize the poem and what we were talking about earlier, the poem itself is a ritual, right? Because I talk about what happened to me, which is Mr. Cat cutting my hair for the first time, and then I talk about Mr. Cat cutting his hair for the first time, and also about how the drag queen helped him do his makeup. But then additionally, I bring the audience in, right? Like, I pass the power along, and I give that same ritual, and the way that it works, right, like the secret magical formula at the end there is that another one of those moments of queer realization is the first time that someone talks about this sort of stuff openly, and you're just like, what is this? What's this? There's magic in the air, right? And glitter starts coming down out of everything. I was really happy to be able to take a moment of like transformation and a moment of of healing and be able to really share it with the audience. Because again, I've been hearing a bunch of poems about people being gay or trans or some kind of queer and just not having anything to do with it, right? Like not talking about queer joy, which is especially weird for me because whenever I think about queer history, I think about a lot of fighting with police and also a lot of dance parties.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, sometimes it's the same day, right? So.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So part of your writing process is really bringing, you know, ritual into it. So writing is a kind of ritual for you?
Writing is definitely magic, right? Like my altar and my writing desk are the same space. Like my patroness sits at my desk, and before I write poetry, I light incense to her in my writing space. If I'm eating dinner at my desk, I will give her some. If I am doing a ritual and I'm by myself, I will off quarters and cast a circle sitting at my writing desk. And I mean, that's not unheard of, right? Gloria Anzaldúa in Borderlands talks about how she has a candle she lights before she starts writing, and talking about writing as, I guess she uses the phrase, a shamanistic practice. I'm not sure I would apply that to my own work, but certainly to hers. And so, yeah, I mean, additionally, and this is something that I think people forget, like writing is a source of religious power, because for a really long time, I mean, ancient Egypt is a great example of this. Early Christianity is a great example of this. The ability to read and write has not always been as widespread as it is. And even now with the internet and the ability being really widespread, to be able to read and write still kind of creates reality. Like how many times has the internet accidentally made something real just out of web pages?
Right.
Oh, man.
That's a great point about that, you know, things we take for granted, like reading and writing, you know, at times were very, very segregated thing, you know, that class and power structure, you know, revolved around.
And it's something that continues to have a lot of like, classist and racist implications, right? Like, being able to read, quote-unquote, fluently changes based on what dialect of English you speak. If you don't speak standard English dialect, then your history and your community's history with reading and writing is bound to be very different. And there are still places in America and places in the world where people don't have access to reading and writing. So, like, if you're the child of a migrant farm worker, regardless of your ethnic or racial background, you're not going to learn to read and write, most likely, just because you won't stay in any one school long enough to do it. And so with the prevalence of the internet and with the bubble that some of us live in, myself included, it's easy to forget that being able to write is magic, but being able to write is magic.
Exactly. And I say that, you know, fully admitting that at one point I was one of those people that used to, you know, call out others for spelling or, you know, grammar mistakes until I realized, you know, that, you know, another form of privilege was the quality of the school systems that I had access to, and that, you know, calling out other people because they misspelled a word or used the wrong version of there is just another way of dismissal.
Yeah.
And a privilege
that
a lot of people don't realize.
Yeah. No, I used to be that same kid, right? Like, I was a straight-A student in school who would be like, that's T-H-E-N, not T-H-A-N, excuse you. And I'm so grateful to the person who pulled me aside and told me to stop doing that.
Yeah. I had a similar experience.
Right. Wow. But yeah, so it's interesting. I was thinking about ritual and thinking about ritual as a form of very deep and very potent healing, thinking about open mics, because we open by consecrating the space at Prog Slam by reading our community values, and we end by cleansing the space, which is kind of a grounding practice, by putting away the chairs. And so the thing that is interesting is the ritual around the slam itself, not the open mics. The open mics feel like a closed circuit, but around the slam itself, there's no protection for the performers. And in a way, the person, people who perform in a slam are kind of carrying all the energy. And so usually when you're doing that, when you're priestessing or when you're aspecting or when you're like just dancing with everyone and moving the energy, being asked to move the entire energy of a ritual that could have 100 people in a room is usually something that requires a handler and aftercare. Like if you're the person calling the fairy queen in a ritual, you're going to have someone else doing the same work with you. Each of you will have a handler. You'll have worked on a contract to do that work for months ahead of advance. And then for 3 days afterwards, people are checking in with you. Are you okay? Are you okay? Are you okay? And I'm not saying that reading a slam poem is as intense as aspecting, but certainly like there's no moment at which you look at your fellow slam poets and kind of give a narrative of like, why are we slamming and how will we be whole after this, even when the judges inevitably give most of us bad scores, right?
Right, right. I think that's such a huge point. Slam really does need that aftercare and also that sense of, you know, closing the ritual and grounding the energy.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, that stuff just, you know, remains running around in the circuit. And I remember periods of, you know, not having that correct aftercare after, you know, say a particular confront your own darkness ritual and the difference from when there was that aftercare.
I would bet that you formed your...
Well, finish.
Are we... Are we at the end there?
We're getting very close. And I was hoping we could have you read a poem out for us, but you know, finish the thought first.
Yep. I bet you came up with your own little ritual, right? Some people have a ritual where as soon as they're done with their poem, they run out the door. Some people have like a particular cigarette or a particular drink, but everyone seems to kind of form their own smaller rituals in the wake of there being a group ritual absent. This is all like just more questions that I haven't answered yet.
Yeah. Well, anyway, thank you for an incredibly stimulating discussion. I wish we had an entire other half hour. We've gone through the show so quickly, but I wanted to have you read us out for everyone who's been listening. This has been Spoken and Heard with Susan Dobie Chase, Rick McIntyre, your stunt villain host, and our guest has been Critter Martins. And if you would, read us out with a poem.
Be my honor. Son, I do not blame you or your snowdrop fawn spots for the hunter. Prince, I accept and love your quivering, your body overwhelmed with desire to live. But I do not love your helplessness, how you crumple in the thicket and shiver, bird flit and sheer stress. So forgive me, Bambi, when I say you have to get up.
Beautiful. Beautiful. Once again, our guest, Critter Martins, this is Spoken Heard. We will be back next week with regular host Susan Dobie Chase. And as she would say, be good to each other. And this is Rick McIntyre signing off.